Hans getting the drop on Bosch and locking him out of the cell so he could try to kill himself. He decided to call Bella Lourdes back and tell her about the threat. Threats were rarely carried out, but he thought there should be a record of this one, should it prove to be the exception. He got her while she was still in the office doing accumulated paperwork. "I've been trying to reach you all day, Harry." "I know. I've been busy and just got the chance to call. What's up?" "At some point we need to talk about Luzon and this bullshit suspension, but at the moment, there's something more important. The gang guys picked up some intel today. The Sanfors put a hit out on you." Bosch was silent for a long moment, thinking about the threat he'd just gotten. "Harry, you there?"
"Yeah, I was just thinking. How good is the intel?"
"They said it was good enough to want to warn you."
"Well, I just got an anonymous call on my phone, my cell. Guy threatened me."
"Shit. Did you recognize the voice?"
"Not really. Could have been Cortez. Could have been anybody. But why call and tip me off if the hit is legit? That doesn't make sense, does it?"
"No, not really, but you have to take this seriously."
"Think they know where I live?"
"I have no idea. Maybe you should stay away from there to be safe."
Bosch saw a woman with a bandana around her head come out of the clinic and start walking south on Van Nuys. She had the same thin build as Elizabeth, but she had turned from Bosch's direction so fast that he was unable to confirm whether it was her. The bandana hid her hair color and length.
"Bella, I need to go," he said. "Keep me posted.
I think it's all talk, but let me know if you hear different."
"Harry, I think you need—"
Bosch disconnected and started the car. He drove slowly down the street, keeping his eyes on the woman. She was almost to the end of the block now, and Bosch planned to go past her, pull to the curb, and then get out to see if it was Elizabeth. He realized that he had concentrated so much on finding her that he wasn't sure how he would handle things once he did. As the woman got to the corner, she turned and Bosch lost sight of her. His plan to identify and confront her on the well-lit Van Nuys Boulevard now changed. He sped up and made the same turn the woman had. Immediately he saw her standing with two men in the shadows of a closed paint store. One of the men had his hands cupped, and the woman was placing something in them. Bosch still could not get a good look at her face. He pulled to the curb directly in front of them. Immediately one of the men ran off toward an alley perpendicular to Van Nuys. The woman and the remaining man stood frozen. Bosch's old Cherokee did not resemble a police vehicle in any way. He jumped out, grabbing a mini light from the center console, and held his hands up so they could see them over the roof of the Jeep.
"It's all right. I just want to talk. Just want to talk."
As he came around, Bosch saw the man pull something from a back pocket and use the woman's body as a blind. Bosch could not tell if it was a gun, or knife, or pack of cigarettes. But in his experience, if you had a gun, you showed a gun. Bosch stopped 6 feet from them, his arm still raised.
"Elizabeth?"
He peered into the darkness. He could not tell and she didn't answer. His hand still over his head, he snapped on the light and put the beam on her. It wasn't Elizabeth.
"Okay. Sorry. Wrong person," Bosch said. "I'll leave you alone now."
He started backing away.
"Damn right it's the wrong person," the man said. "What the fuck you doing running up on people like that?"
"I told you I'm looking for somebody, okay? I'm sorry."
"I could have had a gun, you fucking idiot. I could have blown your shit away."
Bosch reached under his jacket and snapped his gun off his belt. He held it barrel up and took a step back toward the couple.
"You mean like this?" he said. "This what you have?"
The man dropped whatever he was holding and raised his hands.
"Sorry, man. Sorry," he called out.
"Put that damn thing away," the woman yelled. "We ain't hurting nobody." Bosch looked down at the pavement and saw what the man had dropped. It was a plastic pill crusher. They were about to turn the pills she got at the clinic into powder for snorting. Bosch had carried a crusher just like it while working undercover the year before. All at once he was struck by how pitiful the lives of the two people in front of him were. He wondered how Elizabeth could have gone back to this. He put his gun back into its holster and returned to the door of the Cherokee, the two addicts watching him.
"What are you, some kind of cop?" the woman yelled.
Bosch looked at her before getting in.
"Something like that," he said.
He got in, dropped the transmission into drive, and peeled off. He decided to call it a night. If Elizabeth was out there on her own, she would no longer have Bosch looking for her. He headed home, resigned to the idea that he had done what he could for her. He would continue to look for her daughter's killer, but finding Elizabeth would no longer be a priority. He picked up tacos at the Paquito Mas on Cahuenga, and then went up the hill to his house. The plan was to eat, shower, and put on fresh clothes. He would then head to Hollywood to read shake cards with Ballard. The house was dark because he had forgotten to leave any lights on. He came in through the kitchen door and grabbed a bottle of water out of the refrigerator before heading out to the back deck to eat his dinner. As he crossed the living room, he noticed that the sliding door to the deck was halfway open. He stopped. He knew he hadn't left it that way. He then felt the muzzle of a gun against the back of his head. An image of his daughter went through his mind. It was from a few years ago, of a moment when he had been teaching her how to drive and told her she had done well. She smiled proudly at him.
Ballard. Chapter 32. Ballard had the kind of night she had been waiting for all week. No calls for a detective, no calls for backup, no officer needs assistance calls. She spent the whole shift in the detective bureau and even ordered food delivered to the front desk. This gave her time to focus and power through the remaining field interview cards. The pickings were thin in the first two boxes in terms of pulling cards for follow-up investigation. Ballard put only two in the stack that had been accumulating from the start of the project. But the third box produced five cards, including three that she felt should immediately go to the top. 3 weeks before the murder of Daisy Clayton, two officers had stopped their car and inspected a panel van that was parked illegally in front of a red curb on Gower, south of Sunset. When they approached, they heard voices from within the van and saw light inside. There were windows on the rear doors, and they noticed a makeshift curtain had fallen partially open behind one of them. Through the narrow opening, they saw a man and a woman having sex on a mattress, while a second man videoed them with a camera. The officers broke the party up and checked the IDs of all three of the van's occupants. They confirmed with the woman, who had a record of prostitution arrests, that both the sex and the videoing of it were consensual. She denied that any money had changed hands or that she was engaged in prostitution. No arrests were made because there was no crime the threesome could be charged with. Under the law, officers could make an arrest for lewd behavior only if it was witnessed by the public and a citizen reported being offended. The three were let off with a warning and told to move on. Three individual shape cards were filled out. What Ballard keyed on, besides the van, was that one of the men had the word porno actor under his name. He was listed as Kurt Pascal, 26 years old at the time, and living on Kester Street in Sherman Oaks. From the few details that were on the shake cards, Ballard drew the likely conclusion that the officers had interrupted a porno shoot in the van. Pascal and the cameraman, identified as Wilson Gailey, 36, had paid prostitute Tanya Vickers, 31, to perform in the van. Ballard took it a step further and envisioned a night 3 weeks later when they picked up another prostitute for filming and then found out after the fact that they had committed a crime because she was underage. One solution to their problem would be to eliminate the prostitute and make it look like the work of a sexual sadist. Ballard knew it was all supposition. Extrapolation upon extrapolation. But something about the scenario held her. She needed to run with those three shake cards and knew just where to start. She looked up at the wall clock and saw that the shift had gone by quickly. It was already 5 a.m., and she realized that Bosch had not shown up, as he had said he would. She thought about calling him, but didn't want to wake him if he had instead decided to get a full night's sleep. Ballard looked at the three shake cards spread on the desk in front of her. She wanted to dive right in on them, but she had an allegiance to Bosch and how he said the review of the cards should go. She moved to the final box and started looking through more cards. 2 hours later, she had finished going through the last box. She had pulled no cards. Bosch still had not shown up. She checked her phone to see if she had somehow missed a call or a text from him, but there was nothing. She wrote him a text instead. "I'm heading to USC in 30. You coming?" She sent it and waited. There was no immediate reply. Ballard went back to work and used the next half hour before leaving to run the three names from the van through the computer in an attempt to get current addresses and legal status. She determined that, over the 4 years that followed the van incident, Tanya Vickers was arrested 9 times for prostitution and drug offenses before she died of a heroin overdose at age 35. The porno actor, Kurt Pascal, had no record and was still listed in Department of Motor Vehicle records as living on Kester in Sherman Oaks, but the record was old. The driver's license had expired 2 years ago without being renewed. The cameraman, Wilson Gailey, was also unaccounted for. In 2012, he was sentenced to prison after being convicted of intentionally infecting a person with a sexually transmitted disease. He spent 3 years in prison and completed a year on parole. Then he dropped off the grid. Ballard could find no record of him having a driver's license in any state. Ballard had her work cut out for her, but it was now 8 a.m., and she was supposed to meet Professor Calder at USC in 30 minutes to pick up the GRASP data. She couldn't miss the window of time he had given her, because he had a 3-hour computer lab starting at 9. She put the 4 boxes of FI cards on top of the file cabinets that ran the length of the bureau, grabbed a rover from the charging station, and headed out the back door. It was after 8 by the time she pulled out of the parking lot, and Ballard felt no concern about calling and waking Bosch, but her call went straight to his voicemail. "Bosch, it's Ballard. What happened to you? I thought we were doing this together. I'm on my way to USC. Call me. I found some shake cards I really like." She disconnected, half expecting Bosch to call her back right away. He didn't. Ballard looked up a number in her phone and called it. Beatrice Beaupre was a director of adult films, as well as a previous performer. All told, she had almost 20 years in the business. Ballard knew her because the year before she had rescued Beaupre from a man with plans to kill her. In that regard, Beaupre owed Ballard, and she was calling now to collect. Ballard knew at this hour Beaupre was either wrapping up a night's work at her studio out in Canoga Park, or she was asleep and dead to the world. The call was answered after one ring. "What?" "Beatrice, it's Renee Ballard." Beaupre was known by several different names in the porno field. Few people called her by or even knew her given name. "Ballard, what are you doing? I was about to crash. Been working all night." "But I'm glad I got you beforehand. I need your expertise." "My expertise? What, you want to try bondage or something?" "Not quite. I want to run a few names by you, see if anything clicks." "Okay. First one is Kurt Pascal. He's supposedly a porn actor. Was, at least 9 years ago." 9 years ago, shit. The industry has turned over twice in that time. People come and go. No pun intended. "So you don't know him?" "Well, I know these guys by their stage names, and that ain't no stage name. Let me get to my computer. See if he's in the database under his real name." "What database is that?" "Adult casting. Hold on." Ballard heard typing, and then, "Pascal? P-A-S-C-A-L? That's what I have, yeah." "Okay, yeah, he's here. I don't recognize the photo, so I would say I never worked with him. What did he do?" "Nothing. Does it say where he lives?" "No, nothing like that. It's got his management listing and then age and body details. He's a 10 hard, which explains why he got into the business and apparently stayed. He's 35, and that's kinda old for the game. Ballard thought for a moment about what would be the best way to connect with Pascal. For the time being, she moved on. What about a guy named Wilson Gailey? She asked. He might be a cameraman. Is that a performing name? Beaupré asked. I don't make gay porn, so I wouldn't know him. No, it's a real name, I think.
You think?
Ballard heard typing.
He's not in the database, Beaupré said.
But it kind of rings a bell.
You know, a guy with a name for gay porn but who's in the straight game? Let me ask around.
He went to prison about 5 years ago for intentionally infecting someone with an STD, Ballard said.
Oh, wait a minute, Beaupré said. That guy?
What guy?
I think it's him. There was a guy back around that time that was mad at a girl, a performer, because she'd talked trash or something about one of his partners. So he hired her for a scene and put himself in it. She ended up getting SIF, and that forced her out of the business. She went to Vice because somebody told her that the producer, sounds like this Gailey guy, did it on purpose. Like he knew he had it when he fucked her. And then Vice made a case. They got his medical reports and stuff, proved he knew it, and he went to jail.
Have you heard of him since? He got out a couple years ago.
I don't think so. I just remember that story. It's about the scariest thing that can happen in this business.
Ballard knew she had to pull the files on Gailey to confirm Beaupré's story, but it sounded like they were talking about the same man. On the first guy, Pascal, she said,
you could hire him for a shoot through that database? I would send his management a message checking on availability, Beaupré said.
Would there be, like, an audition or something?
No. In this business, look at his reel, which the manager will send me, and you either hire him or you don't. He gets 300 a pop. It says it right here in the database.
Can you hire him for a shoot today?
What are you talking about? What shoot?
There is no shoot. I just want to get him to your place so I can talk to him. There was a pause before Beaupré responded.
I don't know, Ballard. If it gets out I did this for the cops, it might hurt me, being able to hire people in the future. Especially with that management group. It's one of the big ones.
Now Ballard paused, hoping her silence would communicate what she didn't want to say. You owe me, Beaupré. The strategy worked.
Okay, I guess I could claim innocence, Beaupré said. Say I thought you were a valid producer or something.
Whatever you need to do, Ballard said.
What day?
How about today?
Same day booking is kind of suspect. Nobody does that.
Okay, what about tomorrow?
What time?
9 o'clock?
At night, right?
No, morning.
Nobody works in the morning.
Okay, tomorrow afternoon then.
Okay. I'll book him for 4 o'clock and let you know.
And then you'll be here?
I'll be there.
They disconnected. Ballard then tried Bosch again, and once more the call went directly to message. It was as if Bosch's phone had been turned off. Chapter 33. Traffic was a bear getting down to USC. Even with her city car allowing her access to a no-parking zone on campus, Ballard didn't get to Professor Calder's office until he was locking the door to go to his lab.
Professor, I'm sorry I'm so late, she said to his back. Any chance I can pick up the GRASP data?
Ballard realized she had adopted the imploring tone of a student. It was embarrassing. Calder turned and saw it was her and unlocked his door.
Come in, detective.
Calder put a backpack down on a chair and went behind his desk, where he stayed standing while opening the middle drawer.
You know, I don't know why I'm doing this, he said. The LAPD did not treat me well.
He took a thumb drive from the drawer
and held it out across the desk to Ballard.
I know, she said. It was the politics of the moment.
She took the drive from him and held it up.
But I can assure you, she said, if this helps us catch a killer, I will make sure people know it.
I hope so, Calder said. You'll have to print hard copies for your partner yourself. It's the end of the semester, and it turns out I don't have the budget or the paper.
Not a problem, Professor. Thanks.
Let me know how it goes.
When Ballard got back to the car, no more than 10 minutes after leaving it, there was a parking ticket under the windshield wiper.
Are you kidding me? She said.
She yanked the envelope out from under the windshield wiper and did a complete circle, looking for the parking enforcement officer who had issued it. There were only students on their way to classes.
It's a freaking cop car, she yelled.
Students stared at her for a moment, but then moved on. Ballard got in the car and tossed the envelope onto the dashboard.
Assholes, she said.
She headed back toward Hollywood. She had to decide what to do next. She could turn in the city ride, get her van, and head to the beach to follow her routine of paddling and then sleeping. Or she could keep moving on the case. She had 56 field interview cards that needed a second look, and she had the GRASP files, which represented a new angle of investigation. She had not been on the water in 2 days and knew she needed the exercise and the equilibrium it would bring to her being. But the case was calling to her. With the FI cards narrowed and the GRASP data in hand, she needed to keep case momentum going. She pulled her phone and called Bosch for the third time that morning. It once again went straight to message.
Bosch, what the fuck? Are we working together on this or not?
She disconnected, annoyed that there was no way to do an angry hang-up with a cell phone. As she slogged through heavy traffic, her annoyance with Bosch dissipated and turned into concern. When she got back to Hollywood, she headed north on Highland, into the Cahuenga Pass. She knew Bosch lived in the pass. He had given her his address so she could talk to Elizabeth Clayton. She didn't remember the number, but she still had the street. Woodrow Wilson Drive edged the mountain over the pass and offered clipped views between houses that held their ground on steel and concrete pilings. But Ballard wasn't interested in the views. She was looking for the old green Cherokee she had seen Bosch driving earlier in the week. Her hope was that Bosch didn't have a garage. When she was 3 curves from the top of the mountain, she spotted the Jeep parked in a carport attached to a small house on the view side of the street. She drove past and pulled to the curb. Ballard went to the front door and knocked. She stepped back and checked the windows for an open curtain. There was nothing, and no one answered. She tried the door, and it was locked. She moved to the carport and checked the side door. It too was locked. Back out on the street, she walked to the other side and studied the house from afar. She thought about the way Bechtel, the art thief, had gotten in to steal the Warhols. She saw that the carport was supported by a cross-hatched ironwork with squares she judged to be large enough to use as footholds. She headed across the street again. Just as she had done 3 days before, Ballard climbed up to the roof and then crossed it to the rear edge. Every house with a view had a rear deck, and she wasn't disappointed by Bosch's home. She checked a gutter for the strength of its moorings, then gripped it with both hands and swung down to the deck. She dropped the remaining 3 feet without a problem. Something was definitely strange. The slider was open wide enough for her to slip inside without having to push it further. She stood in the middle of a small, sparsely furnished living room. Visually, nothing seemed wrong. Harry? No answer. She stepped further in. She noticed an odd food smell. There was an alcove with a dining room table and a wall of shelves behind it that contained books, files, and a collection of vinyl records and CDs. On the table, she saw an unopened bottle of water
and a paper bag from Paquito Moss, its sides stained with grease. She touched the bag and bottle. Both were room temperature. The bag was open, and she looked down into it. She saw wrapped food items and knew the food had gone uneaten for a long time and was the source of the smell in the house. "Harry?" She said it louder this time, but that didn't change the lack of response. Stepping into the entryway by the front door, she looked into the galley kitchen that led to the carport. Nothing seemed amiss. She saw a set of keys on the counter. She turned and walked down the hallway toward the bedrooms. A series of thoughts rushed through her mind as she moved. Bosch had said Elizabeth Clayton had mysteriously moved out. Had she come back to harm him? To rob him? Had something else gone wrong? Then she thought about Bosch's age and the way he had limped away from her car to the Space Center. Was she going to find him collapsed in the bed or bathroom? Had he pushed himself too far with lack of sleep and exhaustion? "Harry, it's Ballard. You hear, Harry?" The house remained silent. Ballard nudged open the door of a bedroom that obviously was Bosch's daughter's room, with posters and photos on the walls, stuffed animals on the bed, her own phonograph, and a thin collection of records. There was a framed photo on the night table of a young girl hugging a woman. Ballard assumed it was Bosch's daughter and her mother. Across the hall was another room, with a bed and a bureau, all very basic and Spartan. Elizabeth's room, she guessed. A communal bathroom off the hallway was next, and then the master bedroom, Harry's room. Ballard entered, and this time only whispered Bosch's name, as if she expected to find him asleep. The bed was made with a military precision, the spread tightly tucked under the edges of the mattress. She checked the bathroom to finish the search, but she knew Bosch was gone. She turned back and walked all through the house and out onto the deck. The last place she needed to check was the steep embankment below the cantilevered house. The arroyo down below was overgrown with heavy brush and acacia and scrub pine trees. Ballard moved up and down the length of the deck, changing her angles of view so she would be able to see all of the ground below. There was no sign of a body or any sort of break in the natural shape of the canopy of branches. Satisfied that the house and grounds below were clear, Ballard folded her arms and leaned down on the railing as she tried to decide what to do. She was convinced something had happened to Bosch. She checked her watch. It was now 10 o'clock, and she knew the detective bureau at Hollywood Station would be in full swing. She pulled her phone and called her boss, Lieutenant McAdam, on his direct line. "LT, it's Ballard."
"Ballard? I was just looking for the overnight log and couldn't find it."
"I didn't write one. It was a slow night. No calls."
"Well, that's one in a million. Then what's up?"
"You remember I put on the overnight earlier this week that I'm working the cold case with the girl who got snatched 9 years ago?
"Yes. Daisy something, right?"
"Right, yeah. And I was working it with Harry Bosch."
"Without my permission, but yeah. I know Bosch was in on it."
"He had the watch commander's permission. Anyway, here's the thing. Bosch was supposed to come in this morning and go through old shake cards with me, and he didn't show."
"Okay."
"Then we had an appointment with a guy at USC, and Bosch didn't show for that either."
"Did you call him?"
"I've been calling him all morning. No answer. I'm now at his house. The back door was open, there's uneaten food from last night just sitting on the table, and it doesn't look like his bed has been slept in." There was a long silence as McAdam considered everything Ballard had said. She thought he was on the same concerned wavelength as her, but when he finally spoke, it was clear that he wasn't.
"Ballard, are you and Bosch involved in some way beyond this case?"
"No. Are you kidding me? I think something happened to him. I'm not... He's missing, Lieutenant. We need to do something. That's why I'm calling. What should we do?
All right, settle down. My mistake, okay? Forget I said anything.
So when exactly was he supposed to show up on this thing?
There wasn't an exact time, but he said he'd be in early. I was looking for him around 4 or 5.
Again, silence.
Renee, we're talking about 6 hours at the most here.
I know, but there's something wrong. His dinner's sitting on the table. His car's here, but he isn't.
It's still too soon. We have to see how it plays out.
Plays out? What are you talking about? He was one of us. LAPD. We need to put out a bulletin. Get it on Racer, at least.
Racer was an internal text alert system through which messages could be sent to the phones of thousands of officers at once.
No, it's too soon, McAdam said. Let's see what happens over the next few hours.
Text me the address and I'll send a car up there after lunch. You're done for the day.
What? Ballard said. There was exasperation in her voice. McAdam wasn't seeing what she was seeing, didn't know what she knew. He was handling this all wrong.
You're done, Renee. I'll send a car up later to check on Bosch. We've got to give this at least 12 hours. I'll call you later when we know more. It's probably nothing.
Ballard disconnected without acknowledging McAdam's order. She was afraid that if she said anything further, it would be in a high-pitched voice that was near hysterical. She kept her phone out and looked up the number for the San Fernando Police Department. She made the call and asked to be transferred to the Detective Bureau. A woman answered, but identified herself too quickly for Ballard to pick up the name.
Is Harry Bosch there?
No, he's not. Can someone else help you?
This is Detective Ballard with the LAPD. Can I speak to his partner, please? This is urgent.
We don't have partners here. It's interchangeable. I need to talk to whoever he was working with last, on the gang murder where the witness was killed.
There was a pause before there was a response.
That was me.
How do you know about that case?
What was your name again?
Detective Lourdes.
How do you-
Listen to me. I think something's happened to Harry. I'm at his house now, and he's not here, and it looks like he might have been taken.
Taken?
We were supposed to meet early this morning. He didn't show. His phone's turned off, and he's not here. He's got uneaten food on the table from last night, the bed is still made, and his back door was open.
Okay, you need to listen to me now. We got intel yesterday that the Sanfors had put a hit out on Harry because they know he was building a case against one of their OGs. Today, we were working on it. But last night, I warned Harry. I told him. So is there any chance that he just went into hiding?
A sharp pressure started building in Ballard's chest. It was dread.
No, that's not what it looks like here. His keys are on the table, and his car's here.
Maybe he thought the car could be tracked.
Look, I'm not trying to downplay this. If you're saying this looks involuntary, then we'll call out the troops on this end.
Have you talked to his daughter?
Ballard suddenly realized that Bosch had revealed something to her during the course of the week that might be helpful.
No, she said, but I will now.
She disconnected the call.
Chapter 34. Ballard moved back into the house to conduct a different kind of search. She needed a phone number for Bosch's daughter. In the master bedroom, she'd seen a small desk, like the ones found in a hotel room. She went there and started looking through drawers until she found one containing checkbooks and rubber-banded stacks of envelopes. One stack was all telephone bills. She quickly opened the envelope on top and saw that Bosch had a family plan where he paid for 2 cell phones on one account. One she recognized as his number, and the other she assumed was his daughter's. She next opened the checkbook and looked through the registry until she came upon a record of a check for $400 to Madeline Bosch. She had what she needed.
and made the call. It rang through to a message, which didn't surprise her, since Bosch's daughter would have no reason to recognize her number. "Madeline, this is Detective Ballard with the LAPD. It's very important that you call me back as soon as you hear this. Please call me back." She gave her number, even though the girl's phone would have captured it. She then disconnected, put everything back in the drawer, and got up from the desk. Bosch had mentioned in passing that his daughter went to Chapman down in Orange County and was just an hour or so away. She was considering a call to the school's security office to see if Madeline Bosch could be located, but then her phone buzzed and the screen showed the number she had just called. "Madeline?"
"Yes, what's going on?
Where's my father?"
"We're trying to find him and we need your help."
"Oh my God, what happened?"
"Don't panic, Madeline."
"Is that what you go by, Madeline?"
"It's Maddie. Tell me what happened."
"I'm not sure. He missed two appointments with me and I can't reach him. I'm at his house now and his car is in the carport and there's food on the table, but he's not here. When did you hear from him last?"
"He, texted me last night.
He asked about getting together this weekend."
"Are he and your mother divorced? Would he be in touch with—"
"My mother's dead."
"Okay, sorry. I didn't know."
"This is where I need your help. Your dad told me that you two had a deal. He could track your phone if you could track his. I think his phone is off at the moment, but I want you to pull up your tracker and tell me where the last tracking point on it is. Can you do that?"
Yes. I just need to—" "I'll put you on speaker while I—"
"Go ahead." Ballard waited, and eventually Maddie spoke.
"Okay. It only goes up to 11:42 last night. Then it stops."
"Okay, that's good. What's the location of the phone?" There was silence as Maddie checked the location. Ballard hoped it wasn't the house. That would not advance things at all.
It's up in the valley. A place called the Saddle Tree Open Space."
Ballard's heart sank. It sounded like a place to dump a body.
"Can you be more specific?" she asked, trying not to reveal her thoughts in the tone of her voice. "Can you widen the screen or something?"
"Hold on," Maddie said. Ballard waited.
It's like near Sylmar," Maddie said. "The nearest road to the spot is Coyote Street."
"Can you hang up, take a screenshot, and text it to me?"
"Yes, but why was he up there? What is—"
"Maddie, listen to me. We need to hang up so you can send me the screenshot. I need to get that to the right people so we can see if your father is there. I know you're scared, and this is an awful kind of call to get, but I need to go now. I will call you back as soon as I know something, okay?"
Ballard thought she could hear the girl crying.
"Maddie?"
"Yes, okay. I'm hanging up."
"One other thing. I know that if you are anything like your dad, you're going to send me the screenshot and then get in a car and head up here. Don't do that. You have to stay away from your house, okay? It may not be safe."
"Are you kidding me?"
"No, I'm not. I need you to stay away until you hear from me or your father, okay?"
"Okay."
"Good. Send me the screenshot." Ballard disconnected. She knew that Heather Rourke was probably sleeping, but that didn't matter. She called her friend, and surprisingly, the call was answered right away.
"What are you doing awake, Renee?"
"Still working, and I have a situation. I need a flyover up in the valley. Who do you think would do it for me?"
"That's easy. Me."
"What?"
"I'm working an OT shift and have the valley today. We're about to go up."
"Where in the valley?"
"Sylmar area."
"How long until—"
30 minutes.
"What exactly are you looking for?"
"We're looking for a missing police officer. I'm going to text you a screenshot of the location we have on a map. The area is called the Saddle Tree Open Space. I need to know what's there. Any houses, structures, whatever. And if there's nothing there, look for a body."
"You got it. Get that screenshot to me."
As soon as I have it, I'll send. Keep this off the radio if you can. Use my cell to make contact.
Roger that.
Ballard disconnected just as the screenshot from Maddie Bosch came through. She forwarded it to Heather Rourke and started moving through the house, realizing that it might become a crime scene. She left the back slider open and went out the front door and locked it behind her. She didn't get a clear signal on her phone until she took Woodrow Wilson back down into the pass and started north on the 101 freeway. Then she called Lourdes back at San Fernando PD. Do you know anything about the Saddle Tree open space?
I don't even know what that is.
It's just north of Sylmar off a road called Coyote Street. We traced Bosch's phone to a spot there last night about midnight. Then it went dead. I have an airship about to fly over and tell us what's there. I'm on my way.
I'm closer. I can get up there now.
Wait for the flyover. We don't know what's up there. It could be a body, but it could be a trap.
Jesus Christ.
If you people knew there was a hit out on him, why wasn't he protected?
He turned it down. I don't think he took it seriously.
We still don't know if it has anything to do with this.
He might be up there camping and there's no cell service.
Maybe, but I doubt it. I want to keep my phone free. I'll call when I hear something on the flyover.
I'm here and, look, Harry saved my life once and...
She didn't finish.
I get it, Ballard said.
She disconnected. The late morning northbound traffic was light, and Ballard made good time. She took the 101 to the 170 and then the 5 before dropping onto surface streets at Roxford. She checked her phone screen repeatedly, but there was nothing from Rourke on the flyover. Ballard even leaned over to look up through the windshield to see if she could spot the helicopter moving against the backdrop of the mountains that rimmed the valley. There was nothing. As she was crossing San Fernando Road, she got a call from Rourke instead of a text. There was no sound of the chopper's engine in the background. She grew livid.
You're still at Piper Tech?
No, we have a pad we can use at the Davis. Ballard knew the department had a training facility near Sylmar, named after former Chief Edward Davis.
You did the flyover? Was there anything up there?
Ballard could hear her own voice drawn tight by the tension of the moment.
Nobody, Rourke said, but about 100 yards further north into the scrub from the spot on that screenshot you sent me, it looks like there's some kind of an abandoned kennel or animal training facility. There are a couple of sheds and training rings, but no vehicles, no sign of life.
Ballard exhaled. At least Bosch's body wasn't lying out there in the sun.
Can it be accessed? She asked.
Might be tough on the suspension, Rourke said. Looks like there was a washout on the dirt road up there.
Did you take any photos?
Yes, I'm about to send, but I thought I should talk to you first.
No problem.
Do you want us to stay close?
I think I'm about 15 out on a ground search.
If you can fly back up, I wouldn't turn it down.
Okay. We're here till we get a call.
Roger that. Ballard disconnected and called Lourdes back. She told the San Fernando detective what the results of the flyover were and invited her to meet at the terminus of Coyote Street and then conduct a ground search of the last known location of Harry Bosch's phone.
I'm on my way, Lourdes said.
Bosch. Chapter 35. The sound of the helicopter overhead gave Bosch hope, but it made the man watching him panic. Bosch had tried to break through to him all night, asking him his name, asking him to loosen the bindings, and if he could allow him out of the cage to stretch his cramped legs, asking if he really wanted the killing of a cop hanging over him. But the man had said nothing. He just stared at Bosch, and on occasion pointed his gun at him through the cage. Bosch knew that was a hollow threat. He was being kept alive for something else, or someone else. Bosch guessed it would be Tranquilo Cortez. The man had the hardened stare of a convict and the prison tattoos to go with it. Faded blue ink.
Bosch saw none of the symbols associated with the Sanfors. No VSF, no 13, such as he had seen on every Sanfor he had encountered during his time with the SFPD. That included Tranquilo Cortez. Bosch had all night to put things together, and had come out of it sure that this man was Mexican Mafia, La M, and that Cortez might have gone outside the Sanfors to conduct what could be a rogue operation. Abducting a cop was a big move that would put massive pressure on the VSF. Killing a cop was even bigger pressure. Cortez wanted deniability. It had taken three men to abduct him from his home, four counting the driver of the jeep that took him up the rugged hillside to this grim destination. And now, for the past 4 hours, just one silent man to guard him. Every minute that passed felt like an hour, every hour like a day. Bound and crammed into a dog cage, Bosch contemplated his pending death. In the jeep he had picked up enough of the conversation in Spanish to understand that he was ultimately going to be fed to the dogs. But it was not clear whether that was a figure of speech. And if not, it was not clear whether that would happen while he was still alive or not. Through it all, he was haunted by only one thing. His daughter. Not having had final words with her. Not being able to watch her prosper as an adult. It tore him up to think that he would never see or speak to her again. Guilt overtook him as he acknowledged that he had squandered the past several months as Maddie's father, trying to save a woman who didn't want to be saved. In the darkest hours before dawn, hot tears of regret had rolled down his cheeks. But then came the sound of the helicopter directly overhead. In a moment, it changed things for both Bosch and the man guarding him. Bosch had been at enough crime scenes and officer needs help calls over the years to recognize the high-pitched engine whine of the powerful Bell 206 Jet Ranger. He knew that the craft circling above the shed was an LAPD chopper, and that they might already be looking for him. It gave him hope that he might see his daughter again, and have the chance to make things right. For the silent guard, the same sound bred terror, and the fight-or-flight instincts that come with it. He went to the door, slivered it open, and looked up into the sky. Sighting the craft, he confirmed what Bosch already knew. He turned from the door and came to the cage, raising the barrel of his gun. Bosch put his hands up as well as he could in the cramped space, and spoke in rudimentary Spanish. You kill a cop, they'll never stop hunting you. The man hesitated. Bosch kept speaking. He had no formal training in the language, just what he had picked up over a lifetime of working the streets, and from partners like Lucia Soto and Bella Lourdes. What will Tranquilo say? He wants me alive. You're going to take that from him? The man stood frozen, the gun still pointed at Bosch. In his early life, Bosch had spent 15 months in Vietnam. Not a day went by in that time that he didn't hear helicopters. It was the background music of the war. Hiding in the elephant grass, waiting for a dust-off, he had learned early how to read their sound for distance and location. He could now tell that the airship flying above them was spiraling in increasingly larger circles. His guard moved back to the door and looked out. He sensed what Bosch had, that the helicopter was making a wider turn. Then the sound changed again. It became muffled, and Bosch knew the craft had flown behind the crest of the mountain. The shed was out of its sight. The man with the gun turned and looked at him for a long moment, deciding what to do. Bosch knew he was deciding his life. He kept their eyes locked. The man suddenly turned and pushed the door open further. He looked out and up toward the sky. The sound of the chopper was still distant. Sali, Bosch yelled. Ahora! He hoped it was go now, or something else. The man shoved the door all the way open, filling the shed with blinding light. He slid the gun into the waistband of his pants, and moved back into the corner where a green motorbike was leaning against the rusting steel wall. He jumped on it, kick-started it, and then shot through the open door. Bosch's eyes adjusted, and he exhaled. He listened. The airship was coming around on another turn, clearing the mountain and getting louder. With the interior of the shed now brightly illuminated, Bosch shifted his position in the cage, studying every corner and joint for weakness. He knew it was impossible to know if the airship was looking for him, simply conducting a training exercise, or just circling over a coyote. It was true that his abductors had made a mistake last night in not checking him for a phone until they were transferring him from a van to the jeep, but Bosch knew he could not rely on anyone to save him but himself. He had to work quickly and find a way out of the cage. It was only a matter of time before the man on the motorbike came back.
Ballard. Chapter 36. Ballard waited for Bella Lourdes by the Coyote Street gate to the fire road leading up into the hills and the abandoned animal training compound. She was looking at the aerial photos Heather Rourke had texted her and deciding whether it would be better to approach the compound on foot or by attempting to drive a vehicle up the rugged fire road. The compound was not far up and was in an open area that would prevent an unannounced approach by car. She decided she would go on foot and call in the airship if a show of LAPD force was necessary. When Lourdes arrived, she had a partner with her. She identified him as Detective Danny Sisto, and recognizing Ballard's concern, vouched for him as someone Bosch himself would implicitly trust. Ballard accepted her assurance and brought them both up to date on the situation. She showed them the photos from the airship's flyover.
Okay, I think I know the connection here, Lourdes said.
What? Ballard asked. Lourdes looked at Sisto for confirmation when she spoke.
A couple years ago, there was a big animal control bust up here, she said. This place was like a training center for animals used in film and TV, but it had been abandoned for years. The Sanfors discovered it and they were running cockfights and dogfights up here. Animal control got wind of it and shut it down.
I remember that, Sisto said. It was a big story. I think you guys were part of it. This last part he said to Ballard, meaning that the LAPD had joined animal control in shutting down the illegal activities at the compound. Ballard remembered nothing about the events or the media attention it got, but the confirmation that this was a place the Sanfors knew about and had used previously was important. She knew they were in the right place. Sisto pointed at her phone, which still had an aerial shot of the compound on the screen.
We're going to search the structures, right? He asked. Do we have a warrant? This is still private property, abandoned or not.
We don't have time, Ballard said. Exigent circumstances all the way, Lourdes said. Looking at the photos, they identified two trails, in addition to the fire road that led through the brush and up to the compound. Before they headed up separately, Ballard called Rourke, explained the plan, and told her to stand by. The airship was still on the ground at the nearby LAPD training facility, and Rourke assured her that it was ready to respond. Ballard disconnected and looked at Lourdes and Sisto.
Okay, let's go find Harry, she said.
Ballard had chosen the most direct route to the compound, the fire road. She stayed close to the tall brush that lined it, but had the easier climb and the quickest time to the clearing where the compound was located. At the final bend before the clearing, she started to hear a loud banging sound coming from the direction of the compound. It was intermittent. 5 or 6 heavy impacts, and then silence. After a few seconds, it would start again. Ballard pulled her phone to call or text Lourdes, but saw she no longer had cell service. She had left the rover in the car, since she wanted to keep this operation off the air. Each of them would have to approach on their own now, not knowing the progress of the others. Ballard reached the clearing, pulling her gun and holding it at her side as she approached the first of 2 rundown structures. She turned the corner of the front building and saw Lourdes emerge from a trail to her right. There was no sign of Sisto. Ballard was about to signal Lourdes over so they could clear the first building when the banging started again. She could tell that it was coming from the other, smaller building, set at the back of the clearing. Ballard pointed toward it. Lourdes nodded, and they moved in the direction of the sound. There was a wooden door on rollers that had been slid open 4 feet.
It gave Ballard and Lourdes an angle on the inside of the shed, but the structure was rectangular, and its full interior could not be seen from outside. As they got within a few feet of the opening, the banging stopped. They froze and waited. It didn't start again. Looking at the open door, Ballard spoke loudly.
Harry?
After a moment of silence,
"In here."
Ballard looked at Lourdes.
"Hold cover. I'll go in."
Ballard entered the structure, gun up. It took a moment for her eyes to adjust, and then she turned to her right. The far wall of the shed was lined with rusting kennels, two stacked rows of four. Bosch was sitting in the third cage on the upper row, knees pulled up to his chest in the small space. Through the steel fencing, Ballard could see that his hands and ankles were tied. There was blood on his shirt and a laceration on his upper left cheek just below a swollen eye. Ballard swept the rest of the space with her weapon to make sure.
"It's clear,"
Bosch said,
"but they'll probably come back soon."
He raised his bound feet and kicked at the door of the kennel, creating the banging sound Ballard had heard from outside the shed, his fruitless effort to break free and escape.
"Okay, hold on, Harry. We'll get you out," she said. "What's your status? Do we call an RA?" "No RA," Bosch said. "I'm good. Couple of bruised ribs, my legs cramping like hell. I probably need stitches under my eye. They didn't want to beat me up too bad before Tranquilo got here with his dogs."
Ballard didn't think Bosch would go for the rescue ambulance. Not his style. She moved close to the cage and studied the padlock, holding it closed. "They didn't leave the key hidden around here, did they?" she asked.
"Not that I saw," Bosch said. "I could shoot the lock, but the ricochet might hit you." "Only works in movies."
"Bella? All clear." Lourdes entered the shed then.
"Harry, you okay?" she asked urgently. "I will be as soon as you get me out of here," Bosch said. "My knee's killing me."
"Okay, I'm going back to the car," said Ballard. "I think we can put a crowbar through the loop and twist it off." Bosch looked at Ballard through the fencing.
"Sounds like a plan," he said. "Did you send the helicopter up here?"
"Yeah," Ballard said. Bosch nodded his thanks. "I'll be right back," Ballard said. Sisto was standing in the clearing, his back to the shed and maintaining a watch. Ballard passed by him on her way to the road, down to the vehicles.
"Did you clear the other structure?" she asked. "All clear," he said.
"I'm going to need you in a few to twist off a lock."
"I'm ready. Is he okay?"
"He will be,"